Let me take just a minute to again thank you for bringing me so far to spend the day with you. I have thoroughly enjoyed my time here and getting to know Mo and Janet and to see Wally and Sandy again and to meet others. And it seems with just about everyone I've met, there's some connection somewhere. And it's really been a joy to speak for this group today. I appreciate Mike thinking of me when the elders talked about having a series of studies on evidences. And Mike and Monica seem to just be a great fit here, and I wish them nothing but the best in their work here with this congregation. I preach for a group of about 20 people, and we're in the middle of a cornfield, and it's just been special to be able to assemble with a larger group today and spend this time with you. And I hope something I've said today has been of some value as you think about these things. One of my favorite authors is G.K. Chesterton. And as a young man, he was an agnostic and verged on being an atheist. And he set out to read all of the atheistic literature he could read in an attempt to provide an intellectual basis for his atheism. And I've never forgotten one quote he has, one statement he made. He said, "As I laid down the last of Colonel Ingersoll's atheistic lectures, the thought crossed my mind, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. If this is the best that atheism has to offer, give me something else." I hope this morning what I establish is that in some ways there's very little difference between believers and unbelievers as far as our fundamental propositions. We all believe that something has existed forever. We all believe in an uncaused cause. And we all believe there was a moment when there was no life, and then the next moment there was life, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight, because the Christian view of that move from death to life is the basis for my Christianity. I'm a Christian because Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And I believe that not because my parents believed it, and I believe it not because I assume the inspiration of the Bible. When you're talking with an unbeliever, you don't start assuming that this book is true. All you assume is that this book is an ancient document to which you apply the test of credibility like we did this morning. And if it passes those tests, you read it to see what it has to say, whether or not the evidence sustains the propositions that it makes. And I believe the evidence does sustain the proposition that Christ was raised from the dead. There is no evidence I've ever uncovered for spontaneous generation or the unbelievers' doctrine of moving from non-life to life. No evidence whatsoever. All the evidence is on the side of the believer. And when we talk with unbelievers, we're dealing with the emperor's new clothes. I read that story a lot growing up. We have that fairy tale, story. And it's about the emperor who was taken in by some hucksters who claimed that they could spin the finest material out of gold, and he had all of this gold delivered to him. And they start spinning away, and they hold up something like this and says, "Here's your new clothes." And they convinced him that they were magical clothes, that they were the most beautiful things ever seen. And the emperor has the parade, and he puts on his new clothes, and he walks down the middle of the street, and finally one little boy says, "The emperor doesn't have any clothes on." He had been taken. He was completely naked. And that's the way it is with unbelief. People have been taken in by the claims, and they think they are arrayed, clothed, in all of these unimpeachable reasons for their unbelief, and they're just as exposed as can be. And so this evening, I want to go to the New Testament documents and talk about the evidence for the resurrection of Christ. And there are only four core facts that are of primary importance. And these are given by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Let's read the text, then we'll note the four core facts, For I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he arose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas, then of the 12. After that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles, and last of all he was seen of me also, as of one born out of due time. Now the four core facts given by Paul in this text are these. Christ died, he was buried, he arose, and he was seen. Of the four, two are primary, two are corollary. The two primary facts are, first of all, that Christ died. Corollary to that is that he was buried. That's how you dispose of a body. The second primary fact is that he arose. And the corollary to that is that he was seen. Our belief in the resurrection rests on eyewitness testimony, and Paul makes reference to some of the most significant witnesses in this regard, and we'll look at that a little bit later. But let's go back to the Gospels and talk about these four core facts. You know, there are variations in the Gospels on some details, and I talked about that this morning, but there is no variation whatsoever between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John on the fact that Christ died, was buried, arose, and was seen. And to get some of the evidence in front of us, and tell you the truth, I've forgotten what my next slide is, so I'm going to go ahead and hit it just so I don't miss it. But let's talk about the fact that he was died. Turn to John chapter 19. I love the Gospel of John. I'll give you a quick outline of the Gospel of John. John chapter 1 verse 5, which is the prologue, John 1 through verse 1 through verse 18 is the prologue to the gospel. Verse 5 gives us the theme of the gospel of John. And there are two parts to it. Part number 1 is, the light shineth in darkness. Part number 2 is, the darkness comprehended not. That's what the gospel of John is about. It's about the light of heaven in the form of Jesus Christ shining in a sinful situation, and the darkness tried to extinguish the light. In fact, there are three parts, depending on the version you're reading, to verse 5. The light shined in darkness. The darkness tried to put it out, but John says, as some versions indicate, could not. The darkness failed to put out the light, and John's going to write about that. In verses 11 and 12, we have the outline for the book. Verse 11 says, he came into his own, and his own received him not. Verse 12 says, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. Now, in outlining the book, from verse 19 of chapter 1 to the end of chapter 12, John talks about, he came into his own, and his own received him not. And I call this the section of signs, where the light shines in darkness through a series of seven miracles. And these miracles grow increasingly significant in their meaning, in their import. In fact, the last of the seven there is the resurrection of Lazarus. And as the light shines brighter concerning Christ in this section, the darkness grows deeper in its attempt to put out the light. The second main section of the book starts with chapter 13, verse 1, and goes through the end of chapter 20. But to as many as believed in him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. From chapter 13 on, Christ is not so much with the Jews, with the masses, working miracles. He is with his own, preparing for what's to happen. I call that the section of suffering. The book of signs and the book of suffering. And we're going to talk about some things from that second section. Chapter 21, you have an epilogue that ties everything together. But when John writes, he writes just as a dispassionate witness of what he has seen. He doesn't go into a lot of commentary. He doesn't offer many opinions or interpretations. He just lays out for us what he saw. And in regard to the death of Christ, he leaves us in no doubt as to what he saw, namely that Jesus died. And some of the other gospel writers bring in some other facts, but let's start reading in verse 30 of John 19. When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. The Jews therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was in high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs, but one of the soldiers with the spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water, and he that saw it bear record, and his record is true, and he knoweth that he saith true, that ye might believe. That's his personal signature, so to speak, his signature on the affidavit. He says, Christ died. The Roman soldiers were given permission to break the legs of the malefactors. And the reason the Romans did that was to hasten death. You probably have heard this before, but death by crucifixion usually took anywhere from a day and a half to 3 days to accomplish. 36 to 72 hours. And if you didn't die because of shock, you died of suffocation. The Romans would have the cross implanted in the ground in a way so that you hung slightly forward. They would nail you or tie you to the cross with your wrist and your hands and your feet. But you were positioned in such a way that all of your weight was on where you had been tied. And in order to breathe, you would slump down. In order to breathe, you would have to pull with your arms and push with your feet to raise yourself, to expand your lungs, to take in air. Everything about crucifixion was meant to be cruel and unusual. Roman citizens were exempt from this form of death. Crucifixion was designed to be a horror show, meant to keep the rabble in check. You better watch yourself or this could happen to you, is what they were wanting to say. And they would break the legs of victims so that they could no longer use their legs to push up and breathe, and they would suffocate more quickly that way, in just a few minutes. And so they got permission, because of the Sabbath and Jewish scruples and whatnot, they got permission to break the legs of the victims. But when they came to Jesus, this crucifixion team, whose job was to execute people, saw that Jesus was already dead, and they didn't break his legs. And John calls attention to the fact that that fulfilled prophecy. But what they did was to take a spear. One of the legionnaires took his spear and pierced the side of Christ. And John says what he saw was blood and water come out. Now, as to exactly what happened there, you know, we're speculating a little bit. Some have thought that the spear pierced the pericardial sac and blood and fluid came out from the heart. That's probably not what happened. If the heart had been pierced, the fluid probably would have just drained down into the body cavity rather than exiting to the outside. What they've discovered is that victims who have suffered severe physical trauma to the chest, like you might receive during a scourging, where there is tremendous bruising and bleeding underneath the skin, that at death what happens is the blood begins to separate into its constituent elements, into the serum and into the, what, the platelets, the heavier red stuff, the plasma. I knew it began with a P. Thank you, Wally. And the heavier stuff settles out to the bottom, So that if that fluid has collected under the skin and then the skin is pierced, penetrated, it might flow out, the red stuff first and then the clear water. Indicative that death has in fact occurred. And that's what's happening to the blood. That's probably a medical confirmation given us by John that reconfirms the executioner's determination that Christ was dead. And there's another interesting thing provided by Mark. Turn back to Mark 15 and look at this. In Mark 15, Joseph of Arimathea wants permission to take over the body of Christ. And he goes to Pilate asking for the body. And look at verse 44. Pilate marveled if he were already dead. And calling unto him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead. And when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph. Pilate couldn't believe that Christ was dead already. Remember, it took typically a day and a half to 3 days to die by crucifixion. Christ died in 6 hours. In John chapter 10, verses 17 and 18, here's one of the most stupendous claims that Christ made. He said, "Therefore doth my Father love me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again. No man taketh it from me. I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down. I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father." Christ says, "You can't kill me. No man takes my life from me." And goodness, they tried enough times to take his life from him. They'd send the police out to arrest him. They'd come back empty-handed. Where is he? Never man spake like this man. He'd stand on the courtroom steps defying him, and they couldn't take him. When Christ died, when he gave himself up, it was because he was ready to give himself up. It was because he was ready to die. And after 6 hours, having accomplished by his suffering everything God intended for his sacrifice to accomplish, he died. And Mark uses an interesting term in Mark 15, verse 45, I think it is. I'd have to go back and look real quickly. Let me see. It's verse 45. When he knew of it, he gave the body to Jesus. The word for body there, patoma, is not the usual Greek word for body, soma. Patoma is the Greek word that means corpse. It was a corpse that was turned over to Joseph of Arimathea. Christ died. Just no doubt about it. And then he was buried. That's what you do with bodies, remember. We know more about the burial of Jesus than we know about the burial of any other figure from antiquity. We know that he was buried by an individual by the name of Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy disciple, member of the Sanhedrin, who went to Pilate and personally asked for the body. We know how the body was prepared for death, verses 39 and 40 of John 19. There came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100-pound weight. Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in linen clothes with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. And reading verse 40 was all I ever had to read to know that the Shroud of Turin could not have been the burial cloth of Christ. If you've seen pictures of that piece of cloth, it's a long rectangular piece of cloth that has the figure of the front of an individual in the back, as if it's been draped placard style over a body. That was not the manner of the Jews to bury. The Jews buried mummy style. They wound the body. They would put aromatic herbs and perfumes and fragrances into the folds, myrrh and aloes, to mask the odor of the decaying flesh. Christ was buried just like Jews were normally buried in chapter 11. That's how Lazarus was buried. He was in a straitjacket, essentially. He could walk out, but he couldn't use his arms to get out of the burial clothes. And we know that Christ was put in a new tomb owned by Joseph, located in a garden near the site of the crucifixion. It had been recently hewn out of rock. No corpse had ever laid in it. And they rolled a large stone in front of the tomb, which was designed to dissuade grave robbers. And in the extant gravestones that we still have access to, they were built on a ramp. Made it very easy to roll it down, but made it very difficult to roll it back up. And those stones weigh in the vicinity of 500 to 600 pounds. And so Christ was put in the tomb. And then we know something else. We know that the Jews were nervous because of the claims Christ had made, and they were afraid that the disciples, in an attempt to make it appear that Christ had been resurrected, would try to steal the body and then go out claiming that he'd been resurrected. So they go to Pilate, and they express their concerns. And Pilate tells them, you know, make it as secure as you can. And frankly, I don't know if Roman legionnaires were used as guards or Jewish temple police were used as guards. I tend to think the latter, but I'm not just real certain about that. They sealed the tomb, which meant they put the equivalent of the police do not cross yellow tape across the stone. They probably took a cord, a rope, put it in wax on one side, put it in wax on the other side. Any jiggling of that rock, any tampering, it's going to break the wax on either side. It was an anti-tampering device that could very easily tell them if somebody's been here messing around. And then they had the guards out in front of the stone, who under penalty of death would not have fallen asleep. And their job was to keep the body in the tomb. We know all of that about Christ's burial. But then there's something else we know, and that is, 3 days later, the tomb in which Christ was placed was empty. Women were the first ones to discover the fact. Luke 23, 35. John 20, look at verses 3 and following. John 20, after the apostles hear that the body of Christ is missing, Peter therefore went forth, and that other disciple, John, and came to the sepulcher. So they ran both together, and the other disciple did outrun Peter, and came first to the sepulcher. And he, stooping down, and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet went he not in. Then cometh Simon Peter, following him, and went to the sepulcher, and seeth the linen clothes lie, and the napkin that was about his head not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself. The word translated seeth in verse 6 is interesting. It's the Greek word for theory. Theori. Theory. John stoops down, glances in. Peter barges in and looks around, sees the linen clothes lying there, and he sees the head napkin folded, lying by itself, and he's trying to make sense of it all. Peter's trying to figure out what happened here, trying to come up with the theory. But verse 8, there went in also that other disciple which came first to the sepulcher, and he saw and believed. And I'll tell you something about the Gospel of John. There are various levels of belief in the Gospel of John. And here's one of them. We see that John went in, and when he took a closer look, it says he believed. There flashed through John's head the thought, Christ has been raised. Now later, John's going to kind of back off of that a little bit. But here, he has the thought that he kept to himself apparently at the time, just too good to be true, Christ is risen. I picked up a book 20-some years ago by Galia Kornfeld. Kornfeld is an Israeli, I don't know if he's still alive, but he was an Israeli editor, historian, archaeologist, scholar. Not a Christian. But he wrote this book in an attempt to see exactly what historical evidence is there for the resurrection. And here's what he said. If all the evidence is weighed carefully and fairly, it is indeed justifiable, according to the canons of historical research, to conclude that the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, in which Jesus was buried, was actually empty on the morning of the first Easter, and no shred of evidence has yet been discovered in literary sources, epigraphy, or archaeology that would disprove this statement. The tomb was empty. And then comes the question, how did it get empty? A body had been placed in it. What happened to the body? Only two possible explanations. The body of Jesus was either removed by natural forces or by supernatural forces. And the first explanation given for the empty tomb was a natural explanation. Turn to Matthew chapter 28. The first explanation was the stolen body theory. And we read about it in Matthew 28, verses 11 to 15. Now, when the women were going, behold, some of the guards came into the city and showed unto the chief priest all the things that were done. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept, and if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you. So they took the money and did as they were taught, and this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. And I think Matthew is smiling when he writes this. What a joke! At the time he wrote the gospel, the official Jewish explanation for the empty tomb was that the disciples stole him while the guards slept. If the guards were asleep, how did they know what happened to the body? To say, yeah, we fell asleep at our post was to expose them to death themselves. Remember the Philippian jailer? He thought his prisoners had escaped. He was going to do himself in before the authorities had a chance to do it to him. He was a dead man walking. And so nobody with a lick of sense reading Matthew's document when it came out would have been taken in by this. But the stolen body theory was the first explanation for the empty tomb. In the second century, there arose a theory called the swoon theory, advanced initially by Celsus, a heretic, popularized at various times down through the centuries, most recently in a book entitled The Passover Plot by Hugh J. Schoenfeld. And the theory goes something like this. Jesus did not die on the cross. He passed out on the cross. He swooned from lack of loss of blood, shock, you know, losing consciousness. And the Romans thought he was dead, and Joseph and Nicodemus thought he was dead, and they buried him. But there in the coolness of the tomb, he revived and somehow got out of the straitjacket he was in, and somehow, with the guards out front, got that stone rolled back by himself, and then appeared to his disciples, and they thought he was resurrected. And the best debunking of this explanation came from not a Christian, but from a skeptic, David Hume, the Scottish skeptic. And Hume said, can you just imagine if that theory is true? Here's this man, scourged and crucified, on the verge of death, somehow getting out of a place he never could have gotten out of, getting past guards who never would have let him get past them, and appearing to his disciples. He said, can you imagine the disciples looking at Jesus and saying, boy, I can't wait to get a resurrection body like that. They would have called 911 as fast as they could have if they had seen Jesus after all of that. And there have been all kinds of other theories. The hallucination theory. The wrong tomb theory. The women went to the wrong tomb. Peter and John went to the wrong tomb. The twin brother theory. And Kornfeld goes on to say, after talking about some of these theories for the empty tomb, he says it takes more faith to believe them than it does to believe the New Testament record. Well, back in 1 Corinthians 15, the corollary to Christ's resurrection is that he was seen. Five parties of interest are mentioned. Cephas, the 12, over 500, James, and then Paul. Every one of these are significant. Do you think anybody could have pulled the wool over Peter's eyes after the death of Jesus? Well, Peter hallucinated. Okay, he hallucinated. What about the 12? People don't share each other's hallucinations. One person might hallucinate, but the next guy in line probably is not suffering from the same delusion or the same hallucination. We put 12 men on a jury because we think that's a safe number for determining guilt or innocence. And if 12 isn't good enough for you, how about 500? You know, there comes a point where when enough people say, this is what happened, you just stop asking. You don't find somebody else to ask. 500 saw him at one time. James was probably his half-brother. Let's say somebody did deceive the disciples and Peter and tricked the 500. Could an imposter have fooled his own brother as to who he was? Paul didn't just pull these names out of the hat. There is tremendous significance involved with each of these witnesses. I want to close with this. How do we know we can trust the apostles? I mean, people commit perjury and you put witnesses on the stand and sometimes they lie through their teeth. Well, there are tests that law courts use to determine. I have caught Moe's crud, I think. There are tests that law courts use to determine the credibility of a witness. One of the founders of the Harvard School of Law, Simon Greenleaf, one of the most famous of American jurists, he wrote a book called The Testimony of the Evangelist. But many years ago in some bookshop, I found the book he wrote on evidence that for many, many decades was the standard book in American law schools on evidence. And in this book, he talks about the test that a court of law uses to determine a witness's veracity. Let's apply these five tests to the apostles. Test number one is, does the witness have a reputation for integrity? Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:15 that if Christ was not raised, we're liars. But were the apostles liars? I mean, they wrote the book on moral integrity. The cowards of Passover, who became the heroes of Pentecost, were they lying? You know, the apostles were given truth serum. Turn to Acts 22:24. Men have always had a way of getting the truth out of somebody. And in Acts 22:24, we see an example of this. This is where there's been the riot there in the temple precincts in Jerusalem because Paul's been accused of taking a Gentile into the temple. And the chief of police comes to the rescue, and he's trying to figure out what in the world is going on here. And he doesn't think he's getting the truth out of Paul. And so in verse 24 of Acts 22, the chief captain commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade that he should be examined by scourging, that he might know wherefore they cried so against him. Give Paul the third degree. You want to get the truth out of somebody, torture him. That didn't happen to Paul at this time, but it happened on other occasions. No, these men were men of integrity. That doesn't mean they were right. That means they were honest. They were saying what they believed to be the truth. What about their intellectual capacities? Were they capable of accurately reporting what they saw? Well, as far as I know, none of them were a rocket scientist. But Matthew was a tax collector. I mean, you have to be pretty sharp to be a CPA. Peter, James, and John, they were fishermen. But do you think they were capable of determining whether or not a dead man came back to life? Do you think you're capable of making that determination? I mean, there's nothing to suggest that they were so impaired intellectually that they could not have determined if Christ came back to life. Did they have an ulterior motive? Did they say what they said because there was something in it for them, like money, like a promotion, like avoiding persecution? Well, that was often presented to them, but they never backed away from that. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 9 through 13. Verse 9, "For I think that God has set forth us, the apostles, last, as it were, appointed to death. For we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels, and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but ye are wise in Christ. We are weak, but ye are strong. Ye are honorable, but we are despised. Even in this present hour, we both hunger and thirst, and are naked, and are buffeted, and have no certain dwelling place, and labor, working with our own hands. Being reviled, we bless. Being persecuted, we suffer it. Being defamed, we entreat. We are made as the filth of the world, and are the offscouring of all things unto this day." Do you see any ulterior motive in that paragraph? Does their testimony conflict? Now, I talked about this a little bit this morning. There are no contradictions in their testimony. There are variations, such as you would expect from independent witnesses, but no contradictions. And then the fifth one, someone says, well, they were all the friends of Jesus. You'd expect them to say what they said. If there was just one hostile witness, one enemy who could be brought in, who would corroborate what they said, maybe then I'd think there's something to us. Have you ever wondered why Jesus did not appear, say, to Pilate after his resurrection? Or why he didn't appear to Caiaphas or Annas or any of the other Pharisees after his resurrection? I'll tell you why. They were small fry. He was after bigger fish. There is corroborating evidence to the apostolic testimony. It comes from a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus. Public enemy number one. The chief persecutor of Christians in the first century. Abba Eban was an Israeli defense minister or something, but also an historian. Wrote some outstanding histories of the Jews. And when he was writing about Judaism in the first century, he said there were two things that rocked Judaism in the first century, that shook it to its core. Remember, he's not a Christian, just an historian. The first thing, he said, was the destruction of the temple. The second thing was the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. The chief persecutor became the preacher. He was the one born out of due season. 1 Corinthians 15. Who corroborated everything the original 12 had to say. There is no reason for doubting the testimony of the witnesses. Now, what a person has to do when this evidence is laid out before them is to determine if it's enough for them to believe. If it's enough to produce belief in them. If they say, no, that's not enough, I ask them, well, tell me what you do believe. And if I can get them to tell me that, I ask them, now you give me the evidence for why you believe what you believe. Give me the evidence for spontaneous generation. Give me the evidence for the eternality of matter. Whatever it is you believe, let's see the evidence. And whatever they bring up is not going to be within sight of the evidence, the historical evidence that Christians have to offer and on which our faith is based. Now, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God because he was raised from the dead. And that's the basis of my hope. And tonight, if you're not a Christian, I read that in Paris, you can still see the old state books dating back to medieval times, where they have at the top of the page the name of a village or a town, and underneath the name, line upon line upon line of people in the town and the taxes they owed to the king. And in one of these books, there's a page where at the top is the name Do Re Mi. And there are all the lines of the taxes that are owed from people in that town. But written across that page in red ink are the words, Free for the maid's sake. Do Re Mi was the home of Joan of Arc. And out of gratitude to her for her service to the crown, the king forgave the taxes of that town forever. I read that story, I remembered another book. It has a page with my name at the top. And under my name, line after line after line after line of debts I owe the king that I cannot pay. But written across that page in red blood are the words, Free for the Son's sake. Forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. And you can have that forgiveness tonight. If you don't have it now, you can have it tonight. You can walk out of here with your conscience clean, with your innocence returned by the blood of Christ. The greatest event that ever happened in history was the cross, the crucifixion, the death of Jesus Christ. The greatest event that ever proved the efficacy of the cross was the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If there's one here tonight convicted of that, wanting the forgiveness that's found in Jesus, willing to repent, claim him as Lord, and be baptized for the remission of sins, we hope you'll take this opportunity to respond and to come now while together we stand and while we sing.